Well, Chairman Michael, thank you very much indeed for that brief selection from the full criminal record. And thank you. I am honoured to be asked to come to this meeting and to share with you some thoughts relating to this recent book, which was published the other day. I have been thinking quite hard how to convey to you, or how to share with you, the messages of this book. At this time of general social and political turmoil and chaotic manoeuvrings amongst the body politic. Last week I was in Switzerland, where I was addressing an audience who kindly had some interest in this book, and I thought one thing I tried on them, a sort of prop, was to wave at them a copy of last week's Times, and point out that in this one copy, in one day, there were accounts of the chaos in the House of Commons, the Brexit battle, the rude language allegedly being used, and another account of how global warming is now dangerously threatening the entire Swiss Alps and the ski resort sector of the Swiss economy, an analysis of whether the EU structure is now falling apart or coming together or doing both at the same time, a warning that in the age of digital capitalism, the trend of inequality is about to create an explosive reaction, and unless we can get the financial wizards to operate an effective reform of what we still call capitalism, we're all in for a lot of trouble. A query as to how far President Trump wants to go, if he wants to go anywhere, in the all-out war against Iran, following the evidence of the drone attacks, which knocked out Abqaiq, and are alleged to come from the Iranian soil, and the Iranian tanker, which was released in Gibraltar on the promise it wouldn't discharge in its cargo in Syria, which it promptly did, and a splendid report on how the UK's plans to go green by way of low-carbon nuclear power are actually not going at all well, and are only being kept going just by Chinese support. That's just what I told my Swiss friends, was that was just one day's worth of items. And it does illustrate the changing nature of the issues we now face. And it really is a world away, and this is something I begin my book with, from the old debates of the last century about inflation control. We were terrified of inflation, the state versus the individual, the sort of ideological lineup which inherited from the earlier parts of the 20th century, the rise of markets, trade union power, oil shocks, monetary policy, the monetarists were all around us those days. These are all issues which have sort of faded into the background. You hardly hear them mentioned in the daily media, while entirely new forces, new pressures and new crises and new politics as well are paraded daily before us. And they do remind us too of a broader fact which hovers over the whole of this current discussion in this disordered world, that there is going to be, whatever happens in the next few weeks or months or even year, there is going to be no return to what we used to call normal times. Brexit may or may not take place, and we'll probably be discussing that later. Donald Trump may or may not get his comeuppance, now or later, I suspect he will. But the book's message, and that's one I want to elaborate, is that it is a complete illusion to expect the world to return to its previous path, with Europe moving at stately pace towards political union and integration, with the US returning to Pax Americana and genial Uncle Sam, and really business as usual in the global economy led by a confident West. That world has gone forever. So that was one prop I used, and I think it worked quite well. But since then, another prop has really come to mind, which I find even more telling for us here in London. And that is an editorial in a document in yesterday's Financial Times, marked on the blogs very grandly. This is the considered view of the editorial board of the Financial Times, a worldwide, highly admired publication. And what was the conclusion of this editorial board in their first leader yesterday? It was that America was no longer a reliable ally, and therefore we had to think in terms, expect, prepare for the decomposition of the Western alliance. Now, I'm afraid when I listened, I heard distinctly the sucking sound of ostriches lifting their heads out of the sand, because if ever something has been increasingly evident in the network world we're living in, it was that while America is a brilliant place and our good friend, a partner, its role as the reliable superpower in whose hands the world is safe, policing and guarding against all attacks, clearly has disappeared over the last 20 years. I don't think that's fully realised in America, and certainly not realised here in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office until recently, but at least it has reached the editorial board of the Financial Times. So I wanted to then call in one other thing before I turn to the details of my book, and that was a splendid little booklet by my colleague and dear friend, William Waldegrave, who is currently Provost of Eton, a former minister of great distinction, a great classic scholar, and also with a vast grasp of modern science. And he put out a book the other day. He's chairman of a bank as well, on top of everything else. He put out a book just pointing out, with classical elegance and clearness, that the narrative on which Britain had been trying to organise itself, and the assumptions behind all the stances taken on all sides of the last in recent times, drew originally from Churchill's three circles: the special relationship with America, the empire, and our relations with our neighbours in Europe. And he points out that these three circles have evaporated. They don't exist. And therefore, if we want to have a narrative and a story, we need to think very clearly about what, are we in a circle at all, or are we moving into a sort of blank and rudderless existence and direction in the world? But that's very much the starting point of my book as well, that the narratives of the past no longer stand up, and therefore those who start their thinking from stories about where Britain stands in the world so on, really need a considerable reset to grasp fully what is, in Keynes's words, what is actually happening in the world, rather than what they rather hope for or what the things look like from the Westminster bubble and Whitehall. My book actually goes further than William, because I really go on to say, well, if this has happened, if the three circles have broken and disappeared, why has it happened? Why is there this international splintering and fragmentation? Why is there a growing attack on the rules-based order and the sort of integration of assumptions and customs and attitudes which kept that three circles world in place? Why has there been such a huge shift in the last 30 years to Asia, to the point where my friend Parag Khanna at Harvard, who writes a brilliant book I strongly recommend called The Futurization, he's telling us that according to the Asian Investment Bank, that's the old one, not the new one the Chinese have invented, over the next 10 years, the growth of consumer markets in the world will be of the order of $30 trillion, the growth, of which $29 trillion will be in Asia and $1 trillion in the West. This is a considered view of a reasonably impartial banking experts at the AIB. And why the general breakdown of trust and respect and reverence and appreciation of the experience of hierarchies, those who seem to be wise, ranging from parents up to governments and authorities and so on. These are all features we can see swirling around us, and I go behind or beyond the conclusions of William in trying to analyse some of these in my book. Now, what do I... Here I'm afraid I become, or my book becomes, the book of a bit of a nerd. And I'm a nerd because my first answer to that question I've just posed is that it is all rooted in the microchip. It is all rooted in the ability developed 30, 40, 50 years ago to put a microchip on, to put a computer on a microchip, and secondly, to accelerate the processing speed of that microchip, not by ones, not by tens, not by hundreds, not by thousands, but by millions, and is continuing to accelerate. Staggering communication power and revealing and creating connectivity on a scale never before known in history, anything like it, nothing like it, and changing attitudes on every side and changing processes and behaviour. Then the children of that system, the children of that phenomenon, that opening of the iPad in the morning, and just under half the world's population have iPads now, or opening of the iPhone in the morning, creates a sort of power nexus and a sensation of authority and readiness to challenge people who don't agree with you and so on a scale which has never been known before. And this, of course, is where we can see the sub-phenomenon of this age coming out. First of all, the new e-empowered populism. Now, everyone said, well, we've had populism all down the centuries. The populists have risen up at various times and indeed taken over at the time of the French Revolution. The Chartists nearly overthrew the British establishment in the middle of the 19th century. And, of course, in the 20th century, dictators, without the aid of the iPhone or the web or the digital age, were able to mobilise populism with terrifying effect, and having mobilised it, of course, to lead it and mislead it into disastrous attitudes, both to their own interests and to international interests, which led to the horrors of the 20th century. That is what has led to, so that's the populist story on a new scale, one we've never seen before. Secondly, the identity story, people now connecting up with each other and creating, first of all, a happy identity, turning it into relative fury as other people don't recognise that identity. Then an attack on hierarchies and parliament, and all this is all the language of populism, really, but them, the other, they, as against we, the real people, certainly the foreigner, I'm afraid, the foreigner, and many other bogies and demons. This is all vastly empowered by the internet and the web. Then we've seen the polarisation and loss of moderation, as my book rather mournfully begins by saying, this is not a good time for moderates at all. Moderate opinion and nuanced argument get swept aside by the polarisation of opinion, which is enabled. That is what the microchip does, and creates the extremism and the direct street action, of which we've got a good example just outside the door today.
So the masses have been empowered. Karl Marx would have been amazed, I think, when he talked about the rule of the rise of the, and rule of the proletariat and the empowerment of the masses. That is what has happened, although it hasn't turned out at all the way he or anyone else forecast. We have had action, direct action, increasingly seen as the way forward as hierarchies are swept aside, parliaments are denigrated, all politicians are corrupt and so on, and the system doesn't work for us. All in language you've heard every day, and everyone is out of touch. I bet you most of you today, during the course of today, will have heard someone say someone is out of touch. It is the phrase of the age. Everyone feels they are at the centre of things and everyone else is out of touch. We've seen that expressed here in Europe in the Gilets Jaunes. You can see it going on in a rather terrifying form now in the streets of Hong Kong. We've seen in the last, since 2011, the so-called Arab Spring, which was most ridiculously misnamed thing of all. It wasn't a spring. It wasn't like the Prague Spring. It wasn't going to bring, by bringing tyrants down, it wasn't going to bring democracy to the streets to break out in happy harmony. Instead, it was going to bring tribal grievances, divisions, and a cacophony of different views and a lot of violence to every street and every square and every city of the Middle East almost. Most visible, obviously, in Iraq, in the horrors of Syria, which continue to this moment, in Libya, which is getting worse than ever, and I suspect any moment in Egypt. But elsewhere, the general feeling is that we are now that landmines are everywhere, and that the peace and hope of a democratic world has certainly not followed from the pulling down of the various tyrants. So that's my first rather gloomy message. Don't worry, I'm going to get happier a little later on, but that's the first. Second, and related to that, is the giant paradox that for all this liberalisation, pulling down of tyrannies and so on, along with all the fragmentation, along with all the national stridency, we have seen a giant pattern of networks across the planet spreading at enormous speed by people who often don't like what they see, but in fact their own preferences and their own demands are what's driving it, both the commercial, the high-tech platforms and algorithms which are shaping people's views and attitudes in a way that quite often is not understood but is very, very strong, and of course the networks between countries, the new networks between countries, replacing the more familiar institutions of the 20th century, which we were created by the architects of 1945 and the post-Second War world. In my book, I try to get hold of this tableau. I try to cover the last 50 years in really in two sections or two revolutions, the first one triggering the second. The first revolution was the rise of markets after the, well, let's go even back further. We had laissez-faire at the end of the 19th century. We had the feeling of the failure of laissez-faire, as people like Walter Lippmann used to write, that the laissez-faire doctrines had failed to have any moral content, and the rise of the state, accelerated obviously by the two world wars, and the rise of domination of state capitalism, which lingered on after the Second World War into the 60s and 70s, then met by the rise of markets and market economics and market liberalisation, which actually began in this country, and this I think is something that I haven't heard very much elsewhere. It began actually oddly under the much maligned Ted Heath. That was the first point at which people began to say, this can't go on, this sort of corporatist, socialist corporatism is clogging up this country. And how often did you all hear the phrase, well, oh, we won the war and now everyone else all around us in Europe is doing much better. This created a sort of impetus for liberalisation, for questioning the size and role of the state in many areas, and led eventually to privatisation and so on, contracting out and all the other things which then spread actually around the world quite considerably towards the end of the last century. Then, that's the first part, the rise of market. Then we've had the rise of the digital age. not foreseen at all in 1970 or hardly in 1980, although it was just beginning then, but of course bringing a completely new dimension to the then liberalised situation. The cork, as it sense, in a sense, was out of the bottle. I use the fairy tale analogy of the sorcerer's apprentice. You remember the wizard went out, leaving instructions about cleaning the place up, and the apprentice lighted on the formula for getting the buckets and the brooms to do the job. And they did the job, and they did the job, and they couldn't be stopped, and they went on and went on until the whole place was flooded and chaotic. And I think in the end the wizard had to come back and put it all right. But in a way, our liberalisation, deregulation, privatisation of the 1980s was rather similar to that. We were undoubtedly onto a good thing in that the immediate effects were extremely beneficial, and after a few hiccups, people recognised that. But then it began to turn, and then somehow people began to feel that it was no longer in their control at all. And then, of course, you know, as we know, it all led to the vast explosion of subprime capitalism and the Lehman crisis of 2008, 2009, and 2010. So that was the first impact of the digital age, which was not foreseen, which created this funny kind of turbo-boosted capitalism. But with it, it brought a change in the mood about whether just arguing on ideologies, left and right, was really going to deal with the new situation. It invalidated the ideological isms, which were much traded around in the 20th century. It questioned the practicalities of democracy itself as to whether it really works in the way we operated in the past. And as I said earlier, and as William Waldegrave had observed, it collapsed the narrative. Suddenly it was not at all clear where we were going. And now we have rather brilliant commentators and authors like Yuval Noah Harari, who I quote quite a lot in my book, author of Sapiens and Homo Deus, who is really saying with the failure of religion, the failure of the replacement isms, fascism, communism, and so on, and the failure even of liberalism to identify where its heart was and what it was leading to, we were in danger of having a nihilist future in which there was no story at all. So that will take you up to about two-thirds of the chapters in the book. And now my tone is going to change. I can apply what I've said so far to the global situation, but I haven't got the arrogance or the conceit or the idiocy to try and talk about global answers. I can offer, though, some answers for this island, this kingdom, on which we are now all sitting. So are there some answers for us? Is there a role? And my answer is yes. Internally, I think we have to make our own democracy work much better and deliver quality government. That, I think, requires, and I argue at some length, two particular projects in particular, amongst many others. One, there's got to be a device or devices for spreading the benefits of new wealth to millions of households. The capitalism that we've now got, which is not at all the same as the capitalism of the textbooks that some of us learnt at school, does concentrate wealth to an extraordinary degree, and not only does it concentrate it, but of course it's now all visible on the iPad, on the iPhone. It can be seen who is getting what, as they say in the Week magazine, and it can be seen that the concentration of capital, regardless of inequality measurements, which may tell another story, the concentration of capital is now amazingly in the hands of fewer people than ever, on a scale which they can't possibly use, and leads to a sort of sense of disappointment and outrage to the newly empowered masses who feel that it's time they were recognised and that the time that capitalism, if it exists in that form at all, works for everybody, which it clearly doesn't. So I promote one particular area of capital ownership and wealth spreading, developed by Louis Kelso in California 50 years ago, which we tried out under Ted Heath in this country. And there was considerable enthusiasm from Margaret Thatcher, who saw its most important expression in the sale of council houses, but was also determined to spread ownership in other forms, ESOPs, QSOPs, savings instruments of all kind, to more people, and made some progress. It did work up to a point, but then somehow faded, and other things took over, particularly the rise of the pension fund. So all that needs the attention of our financial experts on a degree that is not getting now. And I get my contempt is reserved for those who are always saying we must defend capitalism, and then they spend a lot of time defending a system that doesn't exist anymore, because we're in an entirely new situation. The defence we need is one which delivers dignity and status and ownership to millions of people of the kind which is at the present reserved only for a fairly thin layer at the top. If that sounds un-Tory-like, I'm sorry, but I said earlier we have to move away in our political parties from the ideologies of left and right. The isms, whether capitalism or socialism, don't really describe what is going on in the world or even in this country. Second, I think, and this is not so much in my book, but I was just telling the ambassador from Switzerland, I came back last week convinced that we've got a lot to learn from the Swiss political system because it is so marvellously decentralised. I don't want to exaggerate, but I don't think everyone in Switzerland even knows the name of who their president and prime minister is. What they do know is the name of the people leading their canton and their commune. What they are involved in, because they have a lot of referenda, as we know, and that may make some people shudder, but they have a lot of referenda, which means everybody feels very closely in touch. You don't hear the word not in touch so much in the Swiss political ambience, which you do hear, of course, in ours, because people say, of course you're out of touch, you're at the centre, you're in the London elite, the metropolitan elite, and you don't know what's going on, and so on. I think we, therefore, what I'm really saying is, I think we have to brace ourselves for a very considerable decentralisation, and maybe to save the United Kingdom, which is trembling at the moment, we have to change that U to F. We have to think about a confederal kingdom, which gives even more repleteness and coverage of policy to the kingdoms within our kingdom. So those are the two stories which I think do provide the beginnings of some sort of direction and answer internally and domestically in the situation I've described. Internationally, and related to overlapping that, because of course healthy internal structures lead to a healthy attitude to world responsibilities and international obligations and law, whereas of course populist internal anger leads to the opposite, as it did in the 20th century with disastrous results. But internationally we now have the chance first to recognise that the world isn't actually organised as the Americans and some Chinese keep saying between two superpowers with the rest of us trailing behind. It's actually organised in networks of immense power and activity which are dominating world trade and shaping the global economy. Secondly, for this country, we've luckily inherited a network of common language, common outlook, common law, common accounts, which is called the Commonwealth Network. Forget the idea of Britain being at the hub of something with spokes. That's a very old-fashioned idea. Think instead of a network in which everyone is connected to everyone else. Some nodes are a bit bigger, some connections are a bit stronger, but basically we're talking here about a network of 54 countries, most of them aspiring to democracy, not always achieving it, all of them linked by a sort of sense at the non-governmental level through professions and through, as I say, common language and common working practices to an amazing degree. Aren't we lucky? We didn't work for it. We tried to throw it away. In 2003, the people over at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office tried to take the word Commonwealth out of the system. They thought it was so passe. But one or two people, including Her Majesty the Queen, recognised that actually it was the platform of the future in a digital age, and it was ideally suited, fitted like a glove to the world of connectivity which has now emerged. And I'm talking about not the old networks, they're important still, some of them, the NATO, the Bretton Woods institutions, the European Union itself. I'm talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Region of Economic Cooperation, RECP, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, ASEAN, COMRESA, the Pacific Alliance, a new kind of pattern of European links, which I think will emerge eventually, even though we as the potentially one of the major contributors to it have stepped aside for the moment, and indeed even links with Americana through NAFTA, all of which have been suggested and aired in the media and are under discussion, although none has yet really taken off. So that is the story that I offer in this book at the end. That these are directions which are attainable and achievable. They require huge effort. You may say this is really, to write a book trying to bite all that off is ridiculous, but all I would say in return is we have entered an entirely new epoch. We are in a totally changed pattern of arrangements in our society. I begin the book by commenting on a book, a picture that's above my desk in my London apartment, which is a very good copy, brushstroke by brushstroke, of a painting by Turner called The Fighting Temeraire. The Fighting Temeraire shows a steam tug dragging this magnificent old 92-gun ship of the line, sailing ship, to the breaker's yard. And, of course, it struck a tremendous chord in 19th and 20th century Britain. In fact, it was voted Britain's most favourite painting because it showed the new technology replacing the old and presaged the colossal changes in social affairs and social structure, which, of course, Trevelyan reminds us leads to the politics is the outcome of social change, which was coming. And it led to a kind of technology which John Stuart Mill called reaching the inner domain of consciousness. And I think the digital age has also reached the inner domain of consciousness. And this is where we have to start in preventing the whole system sliding to anarchy, which otherwise it could certainly do and has already done in the Middle East, and providing orderly governance. Somebody wrote to me after the launching of this book saying, oh, but you haven't provided a nice list of solutions. I said, that's the point. That's the point. There are no solutions. We're moving into an age of colossal fluidity in which we're going to have to adjust constantly and continuously in order to survive and provide order rather than chaos. I want to talk more about other things, but like Adam Smith's mother, she plays an important part in this. I'll tell you why later when we discuss it. And the bankruptcy of neoclassical economic system, which is not a system at all, but having raised your hopes with other things, I'll stop here and let the dialogue and exchange begin. Thank you very much.